This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The latest New York Times CBS News poll revealed something that comes as no big surprise. Americans say crime is our country's biggest problem. Let's face it, when you walk down the street, you sometimes find yourself wondering, who's got a gun? My guest, Eric Larson, is the author of a book that examines how America got so gun crazy by focusing on the story of one gun, a semi-automatic weapon purchased by a 16-year-old boy and used in a homicide. In the process of tracing the story of this one gun, Larson writes about what he describes as the de facto conspiracy of gun dealers, manufacturers, marketers, and federal regulators that makes guns all too easy to come by. The Brady Bill will soon go into effect, mandating a 5-day waiting period on the purchase of handguns. Larson says it might not do much to stop crime, but it will address a fundamental paradox of firearms regulation.
For decades, Congress has established that there are certain people who shall not be allowed to buy guns. But what's been lacking is any means of effectively, practically excluding those people from the marketplace, which is really, when you think about it, a ludicrous situation. We have said certain people can't do this. We've never offered the dealers a way to differentiate. And that has led to this equally ludicrous phenomenon of Form 4473, which is the form you fill out. And I marvel at that sometimes. I mean, if I may, let me just put people in this situation. Say you are a felon and you want to go to your local gun store and buy a gun. You're really highly motivated to get this gun because, let's say, you want to blow away the clerk at the local 7-Eleven. You want to do it that night because you need the cash. So you go into this gun store, and what happens, in effect, is the dealer presents you with Form 4473 and asks you, who are very highly motivated, to lie, to do anything to get this gun. He asks you, in effect, to confess to being a felon and, therefore, to disqualify yourself on the spot from buying that gun. Ludicrous. What the Brady Bill does, it takes a small but a necessary first step toward addressing this fundamental paradox. It says, now when you come into a gun store, you must wait 5 days, and in that time period, the dealer must pass on the relevant information about that purchase to the local police agency. It's the first step. What the law does not say is that that local police agency must do a background check. It pretty much leaves it to the agency's discretion.
So some people they'll check on and others they won't.
Well, absolutely. And also I think you'll find some police departments don't want to be bothered and simply don't have the resources. And that's a real serious weak link. You know, if you have 5 days is not a heck of a long time to do a comprehensive background check on somebody, especially if you're in a high volume area where the guns are just flying off the shelves. The police departments are not going to have the resources. So what good does it do if after 5 days the person has already walked away with the gun? If after 5 days the chief of police or his designated gun guy calls up the dealer and says, oh, hey, guess what? That guy was a mass murderer or something. You know, it doesn't help us very much, but it's a first step.
Can you summarize for us what the proposed gun control legislation is now? What has been proposed in Congress?
Well, it depends on which bill you're talking about. There have been some comprehensive regulations proposed, everything to a very detailed assault gun ban proposed and accepted in the Senate. But I can tell you what I think are likely to be the most productive,
mm-hmm.
and those are regulations that are aimed at the distribution channel. And among these, one of the most interesting is the idea of, and this is what initially after the attack on the Long Island Railroad, Mayor Giuliani of New York, the new mayor, had proposed this to President Clinton, who in turn had referred it to Reno. To Janet Reno, which is the idea of a license to purchase. Makes an awful lot of sense. What this would be, in effect, is saying you can only buy a gun if you have a license to buy a gun. To get the license to buy the gun, you have to be thoroughly checked out. It's fair, it's reasonable, it doesn't cause any harm to people who already own guns. You know, to the mass of honest, law-abiding citizens, it's not a problem. But it will have the effect of of at last giving us a chance to exclude those people the law said should have been excluded all along anyway.
So this is what Janet Reno and Bill Clinton mean when they say it should be as difficult to get a gun as it is to get a license to drive a car.
I believe so. Now, another thing that I find particularly valuable is the idea of increasing the regulation of dealers. Gun dealers have for the longest time been kind of the quiet parties in all of this stuff. On the one hand, the law has made, over time, has made gun dealers, in effect, our frontline cops against the migration of guns from the legitimate channels to the bad guys, which is inherently an unfair position. They should never have been put in that position anyway. I mean, what you're effectively saying is, you're giving to the one man or woman who has the highest motivation to sell a gun, you're putting that person in a position of screening buyers. It makes absolutely no sense. But one of the things that I find very interesting is a proposal by Lloyd Benson, who is the who heads the Treasury Department, which of course oversees the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. And his proposal is to raise, last I heard, was to raise dealer fee, the dealer license fee, to $600 a year. That dealer license fee now is $30 for 3 years. I mean, I know because I got myself a federal gun dealer's license. Very easy. $30 for 3 years, no questions asked. You get your license within 45 days. And suddenly you are empowered to buy virtually any weapon in any quantity other than a machine gun or a howitzer, and to have guns delivered to your place virtually overnight. By increasing the fee to $600, what's going to happen is you're going to instantly dry up a certain percentage of the dealers out there. There's something like well over 100,000 who have firearms licenses but do not actually operate a store. These are the so-called kitchen table dealers who got their license to buy guns at cheap prices for their own collections, or perhaps so they could sell guns to their friends, or for any number of reasons, but not the reasons that were initially envisioned in the legislation that said there should be such licenses. And so what happens when you increase the fee to $600, you're going to dry up a lot of that stuff. So instantly you've got better control over these guns. But then the question is, well, is that going to really stop a trafficker from paying the $600 instead of the $30? Well, I would argue, yes, it's going to stop some traffickers. It's not going to stop all. But the big benefit is that by shrinking the number of dealers, by shrinking them, say, by limiting, say, 75% of those kitchen table dealers, suddenly ATF, with its existing compliance and inspection service, suddenly they have more people to spread around. Suddenly they can watch the dealers much more carefully, which is a major problem. We have 245,000 licensed firearms dealers, basic, plain vanilla licensed firearms dealers, and 400 inspectors. It's just inconscionable the way it stands now.
A lot of guns are sold through the black market. What were you able to learn about how the black market gets its guns?
Well, what leapt out at me was that I'm not so sure. Yeah, a black market does exist, clearly. But the question I became interested in is who supplies the black market. And I think it's too easy to say these are stolen guns. You have to take it back. And I think the place you take it is to a lot of these kitchen table dealers. For example, I came across a case in Detroit that the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms had managed to solve. This was a case where two different dealers, both federally licensed dealers, kitchen table dealers who did not actually operate stores, together in 1 year received 3,000 handguns from distributors. And the first thing they did, I guess this is their idea of value-added distribution, they drilled out the serial numbers and promptly turned around and sold all 3,000 guns to whoever wanted them, including kids. They found one dealer who was operating, this is almost unbelievable, his licensed premise. This is the place that he has to put on his application to the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. His licensed premise was a public school in Detroit from which he sold guns. So this, I think, I don't think there's any great secret about where the supply of guns for the black market comes from. It comes from dealers who are willing to sell it into the black market. It comes from traffickers who supply the black market by going to states with very lax laws, recruiting people who live there to buy a lot of guns at one time. Remember, as things stand now, if you go to the right state, and I won't say necessarily which states those are, but if you go to the right state, You can buy 1,000 handguns on the spot, and that dealer has no legal right to question why you need them or whether you should get them.
Well, given that, what would be the most sensible way of drying up the black market?
Well, I think what we've seen in Virginia is very interesting. The idea of one gun a month as a limit. I think that's going to be a hard sell on a national basis. It works. It is very effective in turning traffickers away from individual states. South Carolina had at one time, years ago, been the number one supplier of firearms to the bad guys in New York and passed a one-gun-a-month law and instantly fell to the bottom of supplier states. I suspect the same will happen with Virginia. If it became a federal law, that would be very nice, and it's something I actually propose in my book, that would be a good idea. But I think that's going to be a hard sell. I think that, you know, once again, raising dealer fees, watching the dealers a bit more carefully, insisting that the dealers operate stores. Get rid of this class of privileged Ober-dealers who can operate out of their kitchens. Get rid of it entirely. Why does it exist? The law, in fact, says that you should only have a dealer's license if you are, quote-unquote, engaged in the business. What the law simply has avoided saying all along is, what does that mean? And one of the things I propose is to continue to hold a license, you should have to prove that in your first year of operation that you sold $1,000 or more worth of guns.
From a store?
Very simple. Yeah. Or even that you simply sold them. I mean, a lot of these people just buy guns and pass them on to friends and things. Mm-hmm. So I think there should be some very elementary things done to police the distribution chain.
What do you think of the whole swapping of guns for toys or guns for sneakers?
Very compelling, very appealing. I guess I fall in the camp that says, yeah, you know, it's not going to do much to get the crime guns off the street. But at the same time, it puts out a very necessary signal. It says, look, you know, we're all getting tired of it. We're all fed up. Why not... You know, let's kind of increase the pressure here, and let's increase the social pressure. Turn in your guns. You know, we'll give you something good in exchange. And I think, frankly, around Christmas time, you know, the idea of getting runny shoes and toys and stuff is a fairly powerful incentive for some people. But once again, it comes back to, is it going to reduce crime? No, clearly not. But it keeps the message. It changes the milieu just a little bit.
What is the incentive for turning in a gun for a toy, for a pair of running shoes? You think the gun would cost more than the toy or the running shoes would?
Well, it depends on the gun.
Mm-hmm.
You can buy guns very, very cheaply at gun shows. You can buy guns in private sales very, very cheaply. But look, you know, there's another component to this. Personally, I suspect that the people who are turning in guns are people who really didn't want to have those guns around anyway.
Uh-huh.
And in a sense, we're looking for some reason, some motivation to pass them in. And, you know, this is a small, it's going to have nothing to do with crime. But on the other hand, suddenly you have, let's say you have 3,000 households that had guns but no longer have guns. The risk that the kids in that family are going to use that gun has suddenly disappeared. The risk that you're going to use that gun in a suicide, which is a very high risk, apparently, according to studies, when you have a gun in the house, all these things disappear. And I think that's a positive.
If you're just joining us, my guest is journalist Eric Larson. His new book, Lethal Passage, is about guns in America and the gun industry. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Eric Larson, author of the new book, Lethal Passage, about guns, the gun industry, and gun control. When you were researching your new book, you said that you write a lot of gun magazines and gun catalogs as if you were a presidential assassin. And you ordered accordingly. What are some of the things
got? I have to add the caveat there for all those Secret Service agents who are listening that was merely a literary device. And, one of the interesting things about the gun culture is the kind of stuff you can buy. And if you were a presidential assassin, the world, according to the ads in the back of these magazines, is your oyster. I mean, you can buy anything. And that's a little frightening when you think about what some people can do with the things that they see there.
What are some of the things you ordered, either literature or I guess you weren't ordering ammunition?
I tended to order literature. I stayed away from ordering ammunition and weapons. You can get in a lot of trouble doing the latter in particular. But, you know, for example, I came across an outfit called Paladin Press and began receiving their catalogs and ordered a few of their books, one of which is called How to Kill, which is a primer on how to kill your fellow man, which I found kind of a curious offering to the public. You can find books about how to convert your legal handgun into an illegal machine gun. You can find books that tell you readily how to build a primitive silencer, which have been outlawed since 1934.
You also sent away for a license to sell guns. So you got officially licensed. What did you do with the license once you got it?
Well, I taped it to my wall, partly because the law says it should be in open public display. That license, if you're not careful, can get you in a hell of a lot of trouble, and I chose not to take that path. But what was interesting to me, and the reason I did it, was to get the license to see how easy it was to do. And I was struck by the fact that, yes, I got it very readily, and nobody called me up to say, hey, what are you going to do with this thing? I was not even visited by any local police agency to say, well, you know, you don't have the zoning for this. It just astounded me that I could have taken that license, Xeroxed it, signed the Xerox. This is how you do it, by the way. Signed the Xerox, sent it to a distributor, and the next day I could have had 100 semi-automatic AK-47s.
Did you go to a lot of gun stores to research your book?
I went to a lot of gun shows, primarily. I went to a few gun stores, but that was mostly in terms of the one narrative thread through the book, this following of a handgun. But gun shows were particularly interesting to me because I think that that's where the commerce in guns is laid bare. I mean, it's a surreal experience to drive into, as I did last two weekends ago, to drive up to a gun show. This one was up at the Timonium Fairgrounds outside Baltimore, and to see men walking through the parking lot just kind of casually carrying semi-automatic assault weapons, AR-15s. And then you go inside and you see guys with rifles slung over their shoulders with a sale sign stuck in the barrel saying, I'll sell you this for, you know, $475. And people with for sale signs taped to their backs listing their personal guns that they've got available. I mean, it's amazing to see.
What subcultures are represented at the gun shows or at this particular gun show you were at a couple of weeks ago?
When you say subcultures, what do you mean?
Oh, I don't know, survivalists, people who imagine themselves mercenaries or perhaps were mercenaries or street gangs or hunters.
Oh, you name it.
Just amateur gun collectors.
You find everybody there. You find amateur gun collectors. You find survivalists. You find people who seem to be living in their own little dream world. For example, this one show, I saw a guy who was dressed head to toe in black leather, and he was wearing a long black coat with a black cowboy hat. Of course, he was also pushing a three-year-old in a stroller, which was kind of a jarring juxtaposition. But it was very interesting to sort of see that there were people there who were clearly acting out the part of the Wild West was still very much alive for some. But, you know, many were simply hunters who were looking for a good deal on ammunition, who were simply looking for a good deal on guns. You know, it's also just kind of, I got to say, it's kind of fun in a way.
What's fun?
Well, I've always been, and I have to stress that I'm not coming down against all guns and certainly not against all gun owners. I'm just looking for a little sanity here. But when I go to a gun store, I mean, all the things that I grew up with sort of resonate. You know, I played guns as a kid, and I always wanted to have a BB gun, but my parents would never let me do it, have one. And, you know, one of the most exciting things when I was a kid was going up to the Catskills with a friend's family, and they had 22 rifles, 22 caliber rifles. And we would go up and shoot those things, and that was one of the most exciting things, I think, of my childhood. So I share this sort of, I don't really understand the roots of it, but this kind of, this sense of almost an appreciation of just the machining and the quality of guns and the kind of dreadful appreciation of what they can do. And so it's, I don't know, it's almost like going to see a horror movie. It's sort of chilling in a way to go up to a counter where somebody's selling a .50 caliber machine gun.
You started your book at least a couple of years ago, and since then there's been what seems to me to be an increasing number of shocking mass murders with guns, including the shooting on the Long Island Railroad. And crime and guns has definitely like risen very high as number one concern in the American public. Have you seen the consciousness about guns rise in the years that you've been writing the book?
Oh, clearly. Just in 2 years, I've seen a marked change. People are talking about it, and you go into a restaurant for lunch. People are talking about guns. They're talking about regulations. The atmosphere has changed dramatically.
How paranoid are you now? It used to be if somebody cut you off on the road, a lot of people would give that guy who cut you off the finger, right?
Right.
A lot of people are really afraid to do that now. They're afraid that other driver's going to shoot them if they do that. Are you more inhibited about displaying your anger now in public settings because you never know who's carrying a gun?
Very much so. Very much so. I think it's prudent to be, I wouldn't say paranoid, but to be a little bit cautious about when you flip somebody the bird and when you don't. Because, you know, I mean, even a 12-year-old, you know, once upon a time, if you saw a couple of kids fighting, you could actually entertain the thought that you were going to be super dad and burst in there and you know, save some kid from a beating. But these days, you really got to think twice. It's probably more prudent to call 911 now from your car phone than to leap out there and try and stop that fight.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thanks.
Eric Larson's new book about guns is called Lethal Passage. He's a staff writer for The Wall Street Journal. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.